born right here on WBAI. We bring the program to you Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. without commercial interruption, thanks to listeners just like you. Go to the website WBAI.org. You'll find out information about the station in general. We've been on the air for 60 years, listener-sponsored and commercially free, thanks to listeners just like you. Our pledge line is always open. That number is 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602.
WBAI, New York, New York, New York, New York.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And do make that contribution to WBAI by calling 516-620-3602. Make a contribution in support of Democracy Now!, in support of all of WBAI.
This is Guns and Butter.
But what the Green New Deal is to provide a sort of human face to wealth accumulation, instead of going in with what previously was described as IMF economic medicine, where you impose certain things on sovereign countries, you now come up and say, well, we must endorse a new strategy, which is to invest in the environment and so on and so forth. It's a complex subject to get into, but I can say that, in a sense, this Green New Deal is fake.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosorowski. Today's show, Bankrupting the U.S. Economy is No Solution. Michelle Chosorowski is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we discuss the decision-making process leading to the closure of economic activity, the new normal, the destruction of humanity, real economy capitalism versus financial capitalism, assets picked up at negative prices, the World Economic Forum, the green economy, speculation, and new forms of indebtedness. Michelle Chosorowski, welcome.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
193 countries worldwide have had their economy shut down now for many months, including the closure of schools, all small and medium-sized businesses, museums, churches, and on and on. We are living through an unprecedented self-imposed economic meltdown. You have noted that the orders to carry out this shutdown of economies must have entailed a massive decision-making process by an enormous number of people and institutions worldwide. How would you describe the process by which this closure has been mandated?
Well, it's something which is not easy to analyze because none of these mechanisms are actually in the public domain. What we do know is that the World Economic Forum has played a very significant role in the both in the pandemic itself, as well as in the restructuring of the global economy. I should say that there are several phases in this restructuring of the global economy. The first one was, of course, in February, when the stock markets collapsed, leading to a very significant redistribution of wealth and also the impoverishment of people who had put their life savings in the stock market. And this was an initial phase starting in February. And then in March, we had what was called the lockdown, In other words, the closing down of the real economy. The real economy wasn't closed in February. And then in March, now closing down the real economy in 193 member states of the United Nations is unprecedented in world history. And it requires a decision-making apparatus at different levels of the financial establishment, the U.S. government, foreign policy, the Pentagon, U.S. intelligence, and so on. But it is labeled, in a sense, global governance. I mean, that label there has now emerged, global governance, and that the global economy was, so to speak, closed down, not totally closed down, but closed down with a view to resolving a public health crisis. Now, again, without getting into the debate on the pandemic, closing down an economy is not the solution by any means. Closing down an economy, in essence, disrupts what we might call real life. It's the reproduction of real life. In other words, we produce food, we produce services, and that productive process within the real economy constitutes the basis for sustaining employment, sustaining production, and so on. So that this act of closing down the world economy and then presenting it as a solution, first of all, borders on ridicule from the point of view of economic and social analysis, but it also, it's diabolical. It presents a solution which ultimately doesn't make sense. Anybody in his right mind says that millions of people have been driven into unemployment. They are themselves the victims they themselves are going to have problems of health linked to the fact that they're no longer, their jobs have been erased. So in other words, this scenario is diabolical, but at the same time, it's not being addressed and people ultimately accept it. And now it's become part of the election process in the United States, where one party is saying we're in favor of restoring the real economy and the other party says no, we have to maintain the lockdown to save lives. And you're not saving lives by closing down an economy. Anybody who has common sense will understand that this closure is leading to mass poverty worldwide.
You have expressed the idea that the closing down of national economies worldwide constitutes the destruction of humanity, and you've already begun to discuss this. In what ways, in your opinion, is this global shutdown destroying humanity?
Well, the thing is, if we look at the structure of global capitalism, we can distinguish between broadly two main components. One is the financial apparatus, the money apparatus. It is becoming increasingly concentrated and controlled by a handful of large financial institutions together with the multi-billionaires, the foundations, and so on. Now, that arm of the global capitalist system is also the instrument of debt, of indebtedness. It lends money to the governments, it lends money to the, you know, to private individuals or companies. Of course, the Federal Reserve is part of that. Now, what has happened is that the real economic landscape, the financial sector operates from offices in Wall Street. It doesn't produce anything. It has speculative instruments, which it uses to make the stock market go up and down and then appropriate speculative gains. But it doesn't actually produce anything. And the real wealth lies in what I call the real economy. There's an economic landscape. And what has happened is that this pandemic, and specifically the lockdown, which started in March, what it does is that it destabilizes small and medium-sized enterprises worldwide. It precipitates entire sectors of the global economy into bankruptcy. It's the sectors of manufacturing, retail trade, tourism, and so on, not to mention the service economy. Now, the other dimension when I say it's a war against humanity is that the rules on social distancing, or social distancing on the one hand, but also on the fact that these rules are now leading to the closure of schools. Can you imagine the closure of schools, universities, colleges, trading centers? All of this is being closed down on the pretext and justification that people gathering at school or at the university will start spreading the virus, and it is justified with a health, ultimately with a health criterion, which doesn't make sense. Because when you close down schools and universities, again, you're closing down civil society as we know it. You close down college football in the United States, that's a feature of identity and culture and sport and so on. But the extent of manipulation is beyond description. No more museums, no more concerts, no more colleges and universities. And what happens to the economic landscape in the course of the last few months? Literally thousands, tens of thousands of small and medium-sized enterprises in the United States have been driven into bankruptcy. And this process is worldwide. It's worldwide. And it's this relationship between the financial arm of capitalism and the real economy. And what the financial arm of capitalism wants to do with the big banks and financial institutions, and they're supported by the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the regional development banks, which are part of the UN system, but ultimately they're integrated and they're controlled by dominant financial interests. What that does is it deregulates and destroys the economic landscape, and then it creates conditions in the wake of this pandemic to pick up the pieces, so to speak. In other words, to pick up the bankrupt airline companies. And I can tell you, having reviewed macroeconomic policy throughout my career, looking at previous crises, that those assets will be taken over at a negative price. What is envisaged in the aftermath of this crisis is a massive credit debt project in relation to the governments, both in the developed countries and the developing countries. In the developing countries, it's largely the IMF, the World Bank, the regional development banks, which will be in charge of this, interfacing with the World Economic Forum. But what is happening is that the multi-billionaires will take over real assets, and then they will say, we are prepared to take over these real assets, but you have to give us some bailouts to ensure that we don't run into, into non-performing loans or something. And in other words, they will take over these assets at a negative price. I've seen it happen in other lesser circumstances, where a multi billion dollar conglomerate comes in and says, we're going to take over these airlines, no problem. Give us the price, $400 million, okay, but we'll need to have some support from the government so that, the risks involved, and give us 2 or 3 billion. I've seen this kind of economic arm twisting. And what it means that they are going to appropriate all the assets which they can pick up, and then there will be some kind of a recovery, but then there will be a debt burden which will fall on the governments to such an extent that governments will no longer be able to finance any of their social programs. But in any event, their social programs have now been literally ransacked as a result of social distancing and social engineering. So that is the world we're entering into. The public debt will simply will double or triple overnight, and then the governments will be indebted up to their ears. There will be a fiscal crisis at the state. Why? Because you've got millions of people who are unemployed and who don't pay taxes and who are getting maybe some unemployment insurance payments in between. And so that the whole logic of this of the economic apparatus is changing. The creditors, the global creditors, will say, we will come to the rescue. And the World Economic Forum, which ordered the lockdown, is now coming to the rescue of the companies which have been affected. And so what's going to happen is that the governments will be indebted up to their ears. They will privatize everything which can be privatized. They will implement massive austerity measures. Ultimately, what is happening is that the state apparatus, it has already happened, will essentially be privatized and integrated into this notion of global governance. And the world government would be controlled by these dominant financial institutions, linked up, of course, with the state apparatus of the dominant power in the world, which is the United States of America.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Bankrupting the U.S. Economy is No Solution. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And at the same time, we're going to experience, and we are already experiencing that, a process of global impoverishment, which is unprecedented. And which is the result of a project which was implemented in late January, initially under the auspices of the World Health Organization. What boggles the mind is that people don't see. They're so much affected by this fear campaign, they don't understand what's going on. And what is disturbing is that people are saying, no, we mustn't reopen the economy, and they don't understand that reopening the economy is the restoration of employment and jobs and economic activity. And people are now caught into a discourse which instructs them, because there's fear. They say, if you support the reopening of the economy, it's going to have impacts. The pandemic is there, etc. But this doesn't make sense, because the closure of the economy is also the closure of the public health system. It's the crisis within the public health system. And then there's no evidence that having a mask or practicing social distancing constitutes a solution to this global crisis. So that what is going to happen in the wake of this crisis, restoring the so-called new normal, the World Economic Forum has called it a global reset, and it has already set the boundaries. It said, well, we must start investing in the New Green Deal. Now, the New Green Deal was an initiative set up by Rockefeller. It has a long history. I won't go into the details. But essentially, the mechanisms which are unfolding is that, one, the state of these 193 countries, their governments, the state apparatus is indebted up to their ears, and they are put in a situation where they have to borrow more money to pay back their debts. And in effect, what that means is that civilian governments and elected governments are no longer there anymore. They might be there in name, but who calls the shots? It's the economic powers which stand behind this project.
The Green New Deal, or the green economy that you've mentioned, has been described as a new phase of capitalism. How is the so-called green economy different from capitalism in the past, or is it?
Well, it's, in a sense, it's a continuation of the existing capitalist system. But what the Green New Deal is to provide a sort of human face to wealth accumulation. And instead of going in with what previously was described as IMF economic medicine, where you impose certain things on sovereign countries, you now come up and say, well, we must endorse a new strategy, which is to invest in the environment and so on and so forth. It's a complex subject to get into, but I can say that this New Deal is, in a sense, this Green New Deal is fake. They're saying, well, get out of, fossil fuels, start investing in new industries. And then we discover that the people who control this Green New Deal is big oil, the Rockefellers. And the history of the Rockefellers is important as a family. I mean, they've controlled the oil industry right from the beginning. It was almost a monopoly. And now what they're doing, and they've been doing this for quite some time, is to say, well, we have to invest in green projects. But those green projects are already taken over by global capitalism. And what this constitutes is a gigantic investment fund, which will channel savings, as well as it will have government support, but it will be an instrument, essentially, it will be an instrument of debt management. I think a lot of people have, in a sense, endorsed this. Environmental groups have endorsed it. Okay. Now, when you say, how is it that big oil is supporting? I've reviewed some of these projects for the environmental projects and the Extinction Rebellion and so on and so forth. And then you discover that the Rockefeller Foundation is supporting the campaign against fossil fuel. So, again, it's something which is based on deception. And now we have this great reset, which was announced about a month and a half ago in early June. And the World Economic Forum is now talking about the great reset of the global economy and the fact that this reset will present opportunities which didn't exist previously. And they're going to the extreme of saying that wealth accumulation is more dangerous than the pandemic. They called it affluence. But these people are all multi-billionaires, okay? So they come in and say, we have to redistribute wealth, and we have to think of the poor and income distribution. But in fact, who is calling the shots on this? It's the multi-billionaires who don't even pay taxes. So that the founder of the World Economic Forum, Mr. Klaus Schwab, came up and said, we only have one planet and we know that climate change could be the next global disaster. Okay? Now, this is all, again, global climate change is a frightening word. And CO2 is a frightening word, even though we breathe it in and out all the time. And now what they're doing is that they're saying, okay, we have to address climate change, and then we have to address the issue of green sustainable growth. There are lessons to be learned from this crisis. The irony is that the architects of this collapse in the global economy are now presenting the solutions. They are the cause of this collapse. The financial establishment elites were instrumental in the collapse of the stock markets in February. Some economists will say, well, it's something which is separate. I don't buy that, because there's a fear campaign, there's media disinformation, there's inside trading, there's foreknowledge. All this is based on foreknowledge. And then it really becomes a nirvana for the speculator. They, when everybody is scared, the institutional speculators come in. And these are not individuals. These are powerful financial institutions. And then the price of crude oil collapses. This leads to destabilizing entire national economies. Here in Canada, the province of Alberta has been literally undermined and destroyed. It's the oil producing region of Canada. So that all this nonsense about saying we're going to start with a great reset, which is geared towards eliminating, attenuating climate change and reducing CO2, and then it's going to be sustainable. All this is, it borders on ridicule, because it emanates from the people who initially ordered the lockdown. Okay? They ordered the lockdown. And that, from my standpoint, either this is corrupt and criminal to order a lockdown of 193 countries, or is simply, it borders on stupidity. I don't think they're stupid to that extent. They ordered the lockdown in early March. They instrumented the financial crash in the month of February. And now what is happening, where several months of lockdown and crisis, and millions of small and medium-sized enterprises are literally wiped off the map, off the economic landscape. And these people who are talking about sustainable economies and societies will be there essentially to concentrate wealth in a way which is unprecedented. And we know already, if we look at the landscape around us, I live in the greater Montreal area. Everything is closed. All the restaurants are driven into bankruptcy. The service economy is in crisis. The agriculture is in crisis. And now we see also the total collapse. Well, not the total collapse, but at least a partial collapse in world trade. There's certain commodities that simply don't reach the retail market anymore. And we're going to, and that's another dimension. The U.S. economy in particular depends on made in China commodities. And those made in China commodities in some areas constitute 70% of production. Pharmaceuticals, electronics, clothing, and so on. I mean, there's not a single area of retail trade which is not affected by which depends on made in China. And now you have a trade war and you have the closure of international transport and, you've got a partial closure of international container transport. You're closing down the airlines. You're making it very difficult for companies to come to negotiations. China is a partner of the United States from the business standpoint. It's the first partner. It brings in millions and millions of commodities. And eventually we're going to start witnessing, well, first of all, people's consumption has been flattened. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their car. Everything is on a credit basis. You have a car, you have a house, you have to pay mortgage on your house, and we're entering into a period of poverty and debt, and I would say beyond poverty. This crisis is beyond poverty. It's poverty and despair. People are already poor. And at the same time, it's leading to very significant changes in, well, it's creating problems of mental health. That's amply documented. Then it is also triggering an increase in the drug trade. It is increasing the levels of alcoholism. And that is the kind of social fabric which has resulted largely as a result of this lockdown of the global economy.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Bankrupting the U.S. Economy is No Solution. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And now we have, in the United States, we have Joe Biden on the one hand and his ticket, which says, which is sustaining the lockdown. I'm not making any kind of comment on U.S. elections. I'm a Canadian, okay? But that particular election platform is destructive. There's no doubt about it. Now, Trump is also destructive, but the issue is not one of party politics. The issue is one of restoring employment, restoring businesses, and establishing mechanisms whereby the let's say the U.S. economy is functional. I'm amazed by the fact that the labor unions, AFL-CIO, but throughout the world, the labor unions are complicit. They're not saying we have to protect the rights of workers. No, they're not saying that. The millions of people unemployed, they're not saying restore the economy so that you can restore the right to work. No, they're siding with the, in the United States, de facto, they're siding with the Democratic Party, which says we must maintain the lockdown. So we're in a level of absurdity where people cannot reflect. And now the other important dimension is that people are not organizing themselves against this agenda. They are taking a stance in relation to internal conflicts. Anti-racism is at the forefront, but it plays a role because who are the racists? The racists are these multi-billion-dollar capitalists sitting in Wall Street. Let's look at it in terms of history. It's the whole evolution of social structures. The issue there is that we have a project. It's a neoliberal project to close down the economy and to restructure, and nobody moves against this particular agenda. They are distracted and they join other protest movements. It might be anti-racism, or it might be environmental, and so on. But they are not questioning the legitimacy of their respective governments, whether it's at the state level or the national level, which has ordered the closure of every single business in the country. So that is the world that we're in. And I think people simply have to wake up, use their common sense and say, yes, we want this economy to be restored tomorrow. And nothing prevents it from occurring.
You have said that previously we had the structural adjustment programs of the IMF country by country. Now we have mechanisms of debt where entire groups of countries are subjected to the same IMF programs. Could you describe this newer form of indebtedness? You have said that these states are funding their own indebtedness, and that if we look ahead, we are gearing up for the most enormous debt operation in world history.
Well, I view this as an extension of the neoliberal agenda. It's not something which is new. As we discussed earlier, it's based on the fact that so many countries, particularly developing countries, are already under the brunt of the IMF World Bank conditionalities. It goes back to the 1980s when we had the so-called structural adjustment program, where the IMF World Bank would intervene in the formulation of economic policy in a large number of countries. There were more than 100 developing countries which were subjected to IMF and World Bank reforms. And they were negotiated on a piecemeal basis with contracts of documents and so on. I became very familiar with this procedure when I worked as a consultant for the African Development Bank. And usually there were very stringent conditions. So they would come into a country and say, you have to privatize this, you have to do that, you have to implement trade restrictions. And we have all the trade deals. Now, without getting into the logic of these initiatives, which characterized the whole post-war years under the so-called Bretton Woods institution, which were created in 1944, what is now happening is a form of, I would call it sort of a global adjustment program. You know, you had the structural adjustment program at the level of each country, and the consequence has always been impoverishment, always. I don't know of any kind of IMF program which has really led to any kind of improvement in living conditions. It leads to wealth concentration and so on. And now what they're doing, instead of having a debt operations negotiated with individual governments, they've come up with an envelope and a solution which they're presenting to all these countries. Well, I should mention that there's still a division between the so-called developing countries, those which are eligible for World Bank loans, lower income countries, and so on. And the other categories of countries are the developed countries. In other words, Western Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, etc. These are categorized as high-income countries, and there the mechanism, the institutional mechanism, will be quite different. It won't be under World Bank IMF auspices. It will be the European Central Bank, private banking institutions. It's already happening. It is already happening. Back a couple of months, the Italian government issued bonds, their debt bonds, with the support of Goldman Sachs. And we know that Goldman Sachs also has its inroads into Italian politics. And so they issue these bonds, which are then, of course, picked up by so-called investors. And then what happens is a few days later, the credit evaluation, Standard and Poor credit evaluation of Italian debt collapses to BB. Now, BB is junk bond status. Now, imagine, governments throughout the world have always tried to keep their credit evaluation at A plus or B, A plus, A minus, but they never go lower than B. And now what's happening is that it's a risk to invest in government bonds. Okay, it used to be very safe. It's a risk now because they have created that, and they're lending billions and billions of dollars to governments, and eventually they will pick up the pieces. That's what happens. Privatize is not the word. It's simply bankrupt enterprises which are private. They get sold. And they get sold, as I said, they'll be selling them very often at a negative price. So that's the framework. Global debt operation, very powerful, distinguishing between the developing countries and then forcing the countries into a new relationship of adjustment where they, in fact, what they've done is they said, we're going to help you with this pandemic, and they don't even put conditions. But somewhere in the small print, there is, of course, these are loans which are based on conditionalities, and they'll come in and they will impose whatever they want because the governments will be non-existent. These are proxy governments.
Now, is Standard & Poor's culpable in rating Italian bonds as junk? Are they the cause, or are these bonds really junk?
I think both procedures are there. What has created Italy's junk bond status is the crisis and the lockdown. Its tourist industry is completely destroyed. Its avenues of regional trade are destroyed. There's paralysis. No people are traveling. So that, in effect, Wall Street is responsible for undermining and destroying the Italian economy. And at the same time, it is now, because Standard & Poor's, these credit evaluations emanate from Wall Street, they are now tagging government debt with junk bond status to their advantage, because again there you have a country, Italy, which is a source of a tremendous civilization and history, culture, but also technology and knowledge, and now it is on the verge of it's destroyed. They've destroyed a country, and I can't say anything else. It's the destruction of an entire country. From, if you destroy an economy, you destroy the country. You go back to the Stone Age. I'm exaggerating, of course, but this is the nature of these drastic measures. And that to such an extent, here in Canada, there was a debt instrument of something of the order of $150 billion. In fact, there's a lot more other instruments, which is financing, which serves as a social safety net during the period of crisis, and also sending money to medium-sized enterprises until so-called normalization. Now, what has happened is that $150 billion debt, the prime minister then agrees with the opposition, we will not have any parliamentary debate on this process of indebtedness. It's a no-no, okay? So that what is happening is that these 193 member states of the UN are simply indebting themselves up to their ears. The institutions such as the IMF, the World Bank, they send delegations there, and they said, we're here to help you. Well, they always say that, we're here to help you. And in effect, what they are doing is they are creating a shift in the structure of political power, and they are imposing what Rockefeller has called global governance. Okay, and the Rockefeller family is playing a key role in this whole thing.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show: bankrupting the U.S. economy is no solution. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, bear in mind, you asked me about the evolution, and I've lived through some of the very brutal coups in Latin America, including the Pinochet period in Chile, as well as the coup in Argentina, which led to a military dictatorship. And Wall Street was behind it. David Rockefeller would come in. And of course, the Rockefeller family used to own the oil reserves in Venezuela. It was Standard Oil. Now, what I'm saying is their continuity. The people who supported Pinochet in the 1970s, it was Kissinger and Rockefeller, they're there picking up the pieces today with this World Economic Forum plan to reset the global economy. And it's not a bunch of multi-billionaires which are going to resolve the problem for us. Their objective has always been to appropriate wealth. And this, for them, this great reset, it's big stuff for them. They are looking at the whole institutional fabric of how they can dominate, because they don't necessarily dominate the entire economic landscape. Our economies have been built with small and medium-sized enterprises. Many of them are, on contract with big companies. But nonetheless, it's a different kind of framework. And people will live this in their respective hometowns. And then they will say, oh, no, my grocery store has shut. But various Main Street activities are simply non-existent anymore. And that is the great reset. And that's why people have to move. They really have to, they have to move together. They have to understand it and question the legitimacy of the various components of this project, which is using a public health concern as a pretext and a justification.
You have noted that assets will be picked up at negative prices. What are negative prices?
Well, I can give you an example of a negative price. In 1997, during the Korean, during the so-called Asian crisis, there was a loan agreement under IMF auspices, which was imposed on the Korean government. And within that framework, they had ordered the transfer of some of the big South Korean conglomerates, they call the chaebols, to private U.S. hands. And the way it worked was that it was the case of Korea First Bank. I don't want to get into too much details, but a business group from Texas came in and they purchased, if my memory is correct, Korea First Bank, which was the second largest institution in the country, for something like $400 million. And then they said, oh, but we need to have some security against non-performing loans of the Korea First Bank. So then they were handed something of the order of $1.6 billion of government subsidies to essentially enable them to handle whatever risks might be incurred in a $400 million purchase. So that essentially they're making something like $1.2 billion out of this transaction. That's a negative price, okay? It's not presented as a negative price. There's a transaction, and the transaction for $400 million was conditional upon the government giving them bailout money of the order of 1.6, okay? Now, that's an example where they, in effect, they're picking up a Korea First Bank for a negative price. And mind you, the Koreans are not stupid. They realize that. There was a lot of discussion and debate. Now, I can tell you, airlines, let's say Aeromexico, the whole airline industry in Latin America is on the verge of bankruptcy. The major airlines, you've got the Colombian Airlines, you've got Aeromexico, you've got LAN, Chile. Aeromexico is in a very difficult situation. They're not going to pay full price for these companies. No way. They say we'll take them over, and we'll reassure that they will start functioning again. And of course, some of those companies will simply be wiped out. So that's the framework in which we are.
Now, with regard to the South Korean example, what government was it that was subsidizing the takeover of the Korean bank that you referred to. And was this money paid back?
Well, the money was not paid back. What happened is that this debt operation was launched at the height of an election campaign in December of 1997. And the presidential candidate who entered was Kim Dae-jung, who was a progressive figure and also very critical of the IMF program. But then they said, if you don't accept it, you don't become president. And there was a showdown. They signed the agreement on Christmas Eve of 1997 with the major financial institutions in Wall Street, etc. But the issue there is that the government becomes heavily indebted and then uses that money from foreign creditors to finance bailouts. This is happening in the United States as well. Okay, so you have you come in and you buy Korea First Bank for $400 million, and then they say, well, we have to be careful because they're non-performing loans. Now, the only thing that they can lose, I mean, the irony is that then they get $1.6 billion for a payment of $400 million, okay? So that anybody in Korea could have bought up Korea First Bank at a negative price. Because the condition for purchasing it was that they would give them handouts, okay?
Well, who was giving the handouts? Who was financing this?
The handouts would come from the South Korean government, but it would be based on a multi-billion-dollar loans to enable them to enter into this kind of debt operation, so that in effect. As I said, the government was the Korean government was subject to a multi-billion-dollar debt operation. I can't remember the exact figures, but it was enormous, and there were several other Asian countries which were also affected by this. Now they had to repay debt, and they also received new debt, and then they used part of this debt to compensate the Western companies that came in very generously offering to buy out Korea's economy at a bargain price. Now, General Motors took over Daewoo. I don't have the exact details on that, but I think that they probably got it at a negative price as well.
Well, Michelle, it doesn't make any sense. Why would the South Korean government go into debt to finance foreign companies from taking over South Korean companies?
Well, that's what you call colonialism. There's something like 28,000 troops stationed in South Korea. That country doesn't the policies of that country since the end of World War II have been in the hands of the United States, essentially. And the Chaebols are obedient and so on. They followed they're very much under the clutch of big money capital. But if we want to make analogies to what's happening now, I would say this, something similar is occurring. How is it that some of very large companies who are the victims of the lockdown are accepting the authority of Wall Street? Essentially, it's Wall Street and the big banks which are instrumenting this lockdown. But I mean, you have hotel chains, you have airlines, you have bus companies, you have all sorts of real economy undertakings, and none of these. Why is it not discussed at the Chamber of Commerce? Why is it the Chamber of Commerce in different localities are not saying, this situation where the lockdown is imposed on us, are we going to do something about it? Do we have a lobby group or what? No, they don't. They accept it. And that's exactly what happened in Korea in the wake of the Asian crisis. The Chai Balls, which were really very much controlled by U.S. from a geopolitical standpoint, they didn't complain. They just went ahead with it. And the government had already been instructed. There's a whole history on how that government, how that loan agreement came into being. I should mention that the indebtedness of South Korea in 1997 was due to a very significant, large speculative operation, which was the short selling of the won. Now, the short selling is a process of dragging down the currency of a country, and then through a speculative trade, it's what they call naked short selling. You don't actually have any won with you, but you can still sell them and then make the whole thing collapse. And then when your contract comes to terms, you buy back the Korean won at a very lower price. That's short selling. It's not easy to explain necessarily, but that kind of action was engaged. Well, it can be engaged on the stock market. It can be engaged in currency markets. So that essentially these financial institutions were involved in short selling during the Asian crisis. They were involved in short selling during the current crisis in the month of February. And they made all this collapse.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been Bankrupting the U.S. Economy is No Solution. Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's Long War Against Humanity. Visit globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Everybody, wash your hands, everybody, and everybody, wash your hands. My people uptown, wash your hands. My people downtown, wash your hands. People from the East Coast, wash your hands. People from the West Coast, wash your hands.
That's right. First and foremost, please listen close. Take your time, wash. Use a lot of soap from the front to the back. Back to the front. Sing the hook where you at. That's exactly what we want. You catch a little fever. Shortness of breath. Slight little cough. You feel it in your chest. You should call your doctor. Doctor know what's best. Don't go running to the hospital because you could be a threat. Coronavirus.
Epidemic. Pandemic. Social distance. Non-existence. Don't resist this. Get gone in an instance. If you miss this.
The census is a count of everyone in the United States, no matter your immigration status. The census count is how our communities get billions of dollars for programs that we all rely on. You'll be able to do this online or even over the phone. Now let's go through some of the questions.
This looks easy. So the census asks, how many people live in your home? Do you rent or own? Everyone's name? How